M&A, mergers, acquisitions, mergers and acquisitions. That is how businesses are growing right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, October the 31st. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I'm going to say something here, and I need you to take me at my word that I'm saying it strictly in the economic sense of it, all right? Here you go. Size matters. It just does. There's a story out in Bloomberg today adding up all the corporate mergers and acquisitions that have happened in the 31 days gone by, and it's a lot. Almost $500 billion in deal-making has been done this month, the most in at least 12 years. Two big deals in just the past 24 hours in two wildly different industries, in point of fact. So that is where we're going to start. General Electric is going to combine its oil and gas business with Baker Hughes, a biggie in the oil services sector. The deal, and the does-it-really-need-to-be-stated caveat here with all of these deals, is if approved by regulators. But the deal would let GE cut costs and thus, being leaner and meaner, compete more ably, more notably against the oil services giant Schlumberger. The deal is also a reminder that there are some big bets being made that better times are coming in the currently troubled oil and gas business. Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us going.
The deal would create a new publicly traded company, 62.5% owned by GE, the rest by Baker Hughes shareholders. Dan Riker heads the Center for Energy Policy and Finance at Stanford. He says GE's been in the oil and gas business for a long time, but it also has important expertise outside the oil field.
Software and data processing and all of that, particularly on the industrial side, can make a real difference for oil and gas.
But it also says something about the state of the oil and gas industry, which has taken a massive hit over the past 2 years as crude oil prices plummeted. Scott Schwind is a partner with Jones Day, a law firm in Houston.
It is a sign that some big folks and some very smart folks think that the prospects for the industry are bright.
This isn't a simple deal. It could be a couple of years before the new company is fully fleshed out, but they're betting that
at the end of the day, they're going to be in a better position to take advantage of what's going to be happening in the near term, the medium term, and the long-term future of the oil and gas industry.
The deal would still have to clear antitrust regulation to go through. And remember, Baker Hughes tried to consolidate with Halliburton earlier this year before the Federal Trade Commission nixed it. Skip York is vice president of integrated energy for Wood Mackenzie. He says that experience should help.
There must have been something from the Baker Hughes-Halliburton experience that leads Baker Hughes to believe that this time they fit what the FTC would allow.
And although we've seen a lot of major mergers recently, getting approval is never a foregone conclusion. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
From oil now to telecommunications, as I said, the deals are getting done no matter the industry. CenturyLink is buying Level 3 Communications for $34 billion. And yes, I can hear you saying that you've never heard of those two companies. Trust me when I tell you, though, that while they're not exactly household names, they do play a big part in how you experience the internet. Marketplace's Adam Allington is on that one.
Okay, hands up if you watched the latest episode of Westworld on HBO Now last night, or streamed something on Netflix, or talked on Skype. If so, you probably used a fiber optic network from CenturyLink or Level 3.
Fiber makes the world go round. It pretty much is the backbones that carry the global internet.
Brian Washburn is a telecoms analyst with Current Analysis. He says CenturyLink and Level 3 operate hundreds of thousands of miles of fiber optic cable, which is really profitable considering who their big customers are.
Google and Facebook, they might have some of their own fiber routes, but they're definitely using a Level 3, a CenturyLink, and they're piecing together all of these different parts.
CenturyLink's traditional business was in providing local phone service to rural customers. Washburn says the merger would make them direct competitors with AT&T and Verizon. But will a merger actually create better service? You know, faster download times?
I'm not sure that it'll really result in any dramatic change for an end user in terms of how they see their service work.
Dave Hager is a research analyst with Edward Jones. He says the big driver behind this deal is the stuff mergers and acquisitions are usually made of.
This deal is likely more focused on being able to eliminate duplicated costs in running side-by-side networks.
The deal is still subject to regulatory approval from the FCC, but the companies hope to close by fall of next year. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was, you know, it was fine. I mean, the Fed does meet tomorrow and Wednesday, but don't go thinking anything's going to happen, all right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This global economy in which we all live and work has been blamed for a whole lot of things this election cycle. Too many factory jobs leaving the country. Not enough of our domestic-made products doing the same. Net-net, to hear the politicians tell it, trade is a terrible thing. Turns out, though, the trade's got problems of its own. Binyamin Applebaum writes of them in the New York Times today. Binya, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you.
This is a conundrum, this piece you wrote. For all the press it gets, global trade maybe is not all that anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Global trade gets a lot of attention. Maybe it's never been more in the spotlight in terms of, you know, politics and this presidential election. Both candidates have railed against it. And yet it turns out when you look at the data, we've got less global trade than we used to. It's declining.
Is that because global economic growth is down? Is it something else? Why is this happening?
There seem to be a couple of pieces to the puzzle. One is, yeah, very straightforward. The economy isn't doing well. That means less trade among nations. But there also seems to be something structural going on. We had a long period of very rapid growth in global trade. It was a revolution. Maybe you could call it the Walmart revolution. Mm. Shipping costs came down hugely. China became the world's workhouse and really transformed its economy. And all of those things have kind of played out. And so that period of rapid growth appears to be over.
What effect does this have then on the perception of trade, as you mentioned, in this political season, but also just overall? Because people look at it and they say, oh, no, we're getting killed on trade.
Yeah, it's interesting that perception has lagged the reality in some ways. And that's because a lot of the consequences of that great boom are still with us. People who lost their jobs because of this increase in trade are often still struggling and trying to find their legs. But it may signal a new era in the way that nations are interacting with each other economically. One of the very interesting things that's happening is that places like China are becoming more self-contained economically. They're making more of what they eat. They're eating more of what they make. Yeah. They are basically developing a more complete economy. In the long run, that's probably a good thing for the global economy.
Talk to me for a second about how global trade agreements, again, the topic of much discussion in this political season, play into this. There's the TTIP with us in Europe. There's the TPP with the Asian nations, both of which are getting lambasted.
So one real engine of this growth in trade in recent decades was a series of global agreements that reduced trade barriers. And we're really seeing something of a reversal in that pattern. Major industrial nations, which are the major parties in global trade, appear to be pulling back from globalization. A lot of people feel that trade has been bad for them and they're not eager to see it expanded. Without a new generation of agreements, it's hard to imagine that trade activity will return to its earlier pattern of growth. Mm. There are barriers, particularly in the services area, which is the great sort of growth area in the economy. If we're going to see a new boom in trade, it's likely to come in services, and that's going to require a reduction in some of these barriers.
Is this, and I will confess I cribbed this question from your colleague at the New York Times, Paul Krugman, who, it's worth a note here, won his Nobel Prize for his work in global trade. Is it necessarily a bad thing that the growth in global trade is slowing?
No, it's not. I guess what's concerning here is twofold. First off, nations that have not yet climbed that economic ladder, that have not seen China's rush into prosperity and are hoping to emulate its example, may find that harder to do in this new environment. The other is, you know, that globalization has been a real important force for political stability. The closer we're tied together, the more we trade with each other, the more we interact with each other, the more peaceful a place the world tends to be. Globalization isn't just an economic force. And one concern is that if we pull back from globalization, we lose some of those other benefits as well.
Binyamin Applebaum is a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Binya, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
It's been more than 6 months since what's become known as the bathroom bill became law in North Carolina, requiring people to use bathrooms that match the sex that is on their birth certificates rather than the gender they identify as. The law has become a key political talking point as it was passed and signed back in March, on both sides, that is. But out in the world, away from stump speeches and political point scoring, HB 2, as it's also called, has had a whole lot of unintended economic consequences. From WUNC, Jeff Tiberi reports.
It's lunchtime at Gassan's in Greensboro. Meat hits the grill, and French fries drop into hot oil.
We're like a quick-service Mediterranean restaurant. One of our biggest and most popular items is the steak and cheese sub.
With onions, of course. Ziad Flahan is operations manager here. His mom and dad started the business 41 years ago. Gassan's now has 5 locations and a food truck. One restaurant is just a block away from the Greensboro Coliseum, where the new law is affecting the bottom line.
That is a lower volume store for us, so we are largely dependent on events that come to the Coliseum and tourism and people that come to this area.
Flahan says between a canceled Bruce Springsteen concert and 6 conferences that were called off, that restaurant has already lost $20,000 in revenue. March Madness basketball was supposed to take place here next spring. It won't.
It makes us reassess and think about, you know, if this thing doesn't get repealed, how long can we last here, you know? And when is it time to maybe make hard decisions as far as closing up shop?
Along with vanished revenue at restaurants and hotels, the cancellation of events affects caterers, transportation services, linen rental shops, pesticide companies, even banks and credit unions that handle payroll for many of these contractors. So the law has already rippled through the local economy, according to Henry Fourier, president of Greensboro Area Convention and Visitors Bureau.
It certainly tarnished us. We have worked very hard to establish a brand in the sports market, for one, and I feel that that has just deteriorated.
Fourier believes it's just a matter of time before something is done. Change could come from the legislature or the courts, but nothing is imminent. He says Greensboro can't truly work on fixing the damage until the law is gone. Across the state, these effects aren't necessarily as drastic everywhere. About 50 miles east is the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill region, called the Triangle. It saw Deutsche Bank halt job expansion plans and the NCAA relocate several sporting events. It's also here that Tina Travis is on the go. She started Errand Girl in 2009, a concierge business that serves the Triangle.
It's not a crippling blow to the business.
And Travis also talks to other small business owners in her area on a regular basis.
We all get together at the end of all of our quarters and we say, well, how did you do? What are you doing new? What are you doing different?
She estimates 10 to 15% of her business comes from out-of-town visitors and says her company is diverse enough in the services it offers that House Bill 2, or HB 2, has not had a noticeable effect. She adds other concierge services in the Triangle are doing okay.
And I must say that I have not heard that statement that because of HB 2, my business is down a little bit, or my business is up a little bit. It seems to be something that we are flowing with.
There hasn't been a definitive study yet on how the law may have affected the economy. So far, the stream of canceled conferences, concerts, and sporting events doesn't seem to have affected the state's unemployment rate, which actually dropped over the last few months. But even small losses can have large consequences for some local business owners. In North Carolina, I'm Jeff Tiberi for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So in fact, it was bringing tea home.
They drink enough of it, the Brits do, but they hadn't really grown it till now. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 18 points on this Halloween, 0.1%, 18,142. The NASDAQ down just about a point, fraction of a percent, obviously, 5189. The S&P 500 down a quarter point, also a fraction, 2126. Talk about the big deals in the news today. General Electric off 0.4% after it said it plans to merge its oil and gas business with Baker Hughes. Baker down 6%. CenturyLink lost 12.5% on the news of its deal to buy Level 3. Level 3 up 3.8%. AT&T and Time Warner, by the by, still working out their deal to investors and regulators. AT&T, which is going to buy Time Warner, rose 0.7%. Time Warner up 1.7%. It's Halloween, as I said, and you know what that means? 9 weeks of overeating and drinking is what that means, leading to inevitable weight gain, and thus Weight Watchers up 1.5% today. Nutrisystem gained 1.1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down just a fraction, 1.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the great early selling points of ride-sharing services like Uber and Lyft, for instance, was that they said they would be equalizers, letting drivers and riders alike have flexibility and easy access to transportation. Researchers at MIT, Stanford, and the University of Washington have found otherwise, though. They had groups of black and white research assistants request some 1,500 rides in Seattle and Boston. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace reports on what happened next.
Take this story on the comedy podcast Two Dope Queens. Co-host Jessica Williams is hailing a cab after a party. Her boyfriend Blaine, who's white, is standing further down the curb.
And I see this cab with its lights on come towards me. And then zoom past me, and then stop over at Blaine!
No! In theory, an Uber or Lyft could prevent passengers from standing on a curb being judged, but maybe the judging is just less visible. Christopher Knittle is an econ professor at MIT and a co-author of the ride-sharing study. He says Uber drivers don't see names until they accept a ride, and when research assistants requested an Uber using what the study calls an African-American-sounding name,
the chances that a Uber driver accepted their ride, observed their name, and then canceled their ride more than doubled.
For Lyft, drivers see a name and photo up front, and the study found black riders waited slightly longer to get rides accepted, the virtual equivalent of standing on a curb. Uber declined an interview, but sent a statement saying it's working to fight discrimination. Adrian Durbin, a spokesman for Lyft, says the company is proud of how accessible it is to communities of color. As to whether there's discrimination at play,
I'm not going to speculate on that.
Professor Ashley Rosette at Duke's Fuqua School of Business says this kind of bias against black people is commonplace and well-documented.
Oftentimes, we aren't even aware that we hold these biases, but nonetheless, they persist again and again.
As for solutions, she says the companies should do more education. The study's authors suggest Uber and Lyft could stop showing passenger names and photos entirely. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
Here we are going on 9 years since the Great Recession started, and while a lot of things have bounced back, in a lot of states, funding for public schools still hasn't. At least 23 states are going to have less general funding for education this school year than they did in 2008. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Arizona is among the worst off. In 2014, its total education funding was almost 37% lower than just before the recession, and the state is still cutting. The budget is being squeezed not just by the weak recovery, but from ongoing tax cuts.
Arizona, I think, has cut more from public education than just about any state since 2008.
David Lujan with Children's Action Alliance says here's what that looks like. Last year, almost a third of the state's school buses failed safety inspections. Teachers are using outdated textbooks and technology, if there is a teacher, that is.
We had over 2,000 classrooms this school year that started without a qualified certified teacher because school districts just are not able to retain or hire teachers.
Public schools get almost half their funding from state governments. Most of the rest is local, mainly from property taxes. And in wealthier districts, that can make up for some shortfalls in state funding. But in Arizona, Alabama, Colorado, and 17 other states, local funding has been shrinking too. Michael Leachman co-authored the report from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
My fear is that in these states that have cut so deeply, we're going to see reduced outcomes for kids in those states.
Funding doesn't always determine the quality of a school, but it can make a big difference, especially for kids from low-income families. A recent study found that poor children who went to schools that got a permanent 10% increase in funding were much more likely to finish high school and earned more as adults. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
These are not easy days for the Brits. The pound has been getting shellacked since the Brexit vote back in June. Britain's soon-to-be ex-European Union partners aren't giving it any love as the start of negotiations over Britain's withdrawal draws near. Those talks are expected to begin in March, by the way. So what does one do as a Brit when one is up against it? One has a cuppa, is what one does, a nice cup of tea, most of which, it turns out, is imported. Now, though, England has its own, albeit small, tea plantation, doing pretty well, too. In fact, Marketplace's Stephen Beard visited the Tregothnan plantation in the southwestern county of Cornwall.
Could this be the sound of Britain's salvation? Not heavy duty, it's true, but in a corrugated iron shed in the grounds of a stately home in Cornwall, this tea packaging contraption has, in its own small way, been boosting British exports. Machinist Alwyn Keenor.
We're up to a full production of 40 plus hours a week to maintain the orders.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's full on, absolutely full on.
They've been growing tea at Tregothnan for more than a decade, a byproduct of the estate's botanic garden.
Putting some nice rare plants in this morning.
What are you putting in?
Reevesia pubescens, which is a plant from China. Very, very rare.
Staking up his latest collection of exotic plants, head gardener Neil Bennett. He says the estate's been growing camellias for more than 200 years, so there was no reason why the tea bush, Camellia sinensis, shouldn't have done well here.
Tea is actually very easy because we get the microclimates in Cornwall because of the Gulf Stream. Tea doesn't like extremes of temperature, so Cornwall's perfect.
It's not too cold?
No, all our seasons merge into one, basically, in Cornwall.
But it's not as warm here as in Darjeeling, for example.
Actually, they're very similar to temperatures at times.
And there's the rain. In Cornwall, it rains buckets. In a typical downpour, I went for a walk through the estate's 150 acres of tea bushes with marketing manager Bella Percy Hughes.
They're all planted in rows so that you can get through and pluck from the top of them.
And it's plucking, not picking.
That's right, you pluck leaves off a tea bush.
And it's raining.
And it's pouring.
Good for the tea.
It's very good.
You never complain about the rain here.
We never complain about rainfall. No, it's very good for the tea bushes. You can see they look so happy, actually. All that lighter green is new growth.
This year, Tregothnan had a bumper harvest, well over 10 tonnes of white, green and black tea. Sales are growing too, at 30% a year. They're still modest, around $1.5 million, but the boss, Jonathan Jones, the former head gardener who hit on the idea of growing tea here, is very optimistic, especially about exports, thanks to Brexit.
Brand Britain has never been higher. Brexit has done that for us anyway. We did the Olympics, we did lots of things, but suddenly we did Brexit and everybody's talking about Britain.
Since the Brexit referendum in June, he says inquiries have flooded in from around the world. He was already selling 50% of his tea abroad, including, incredibly, to both China and India.
Yes, the leaves are great and they have to be super quality, but it's the whole British experience that they're buying into.
But as Chinese and Indian companies snap up major British manufacturing firms, isn't setting up a tea plantation a bit of a come-down? Not at all, says Jones.
The reason that tea is one of the biggest industries today in Kenya is because the Brits took it there. We took it to India. It now employs over 1 million people in India. But where it had never come before is, in fact, to the most famous tea-drinking country in the world, which is the UK. So, in fact, it was bringing tea home.
So how does it taste, England's only homegrown tea?
We're going to infuse a pot of our single estate tea. There we go.
It tasted fine, but the price per pot, that is a little hard to swallow.
£36.
£36?
Yes.
$40 to $50?
Yeah. Yes, but it's very rare, extremely delicious, and it's something that you wouldn't get every day.
And rich Indian and Chinese connoisseurs seem to be lapping it up. At Tregothnan in Cornwall, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, by way of the UK as it happens, Volvo's got a self-driving car project going on over there. They're going to put 100 autonomous cars on the road by 2018. The thing is, those cars are going to be unmarked without obvious indications that they are self-driving. The Guardian newspaper says Volvo engineers are worried that their autonomous experiments will be bullied by other drivers, which kind of does make sense, right? If you saw a car that you knew had to follow the rules, tempting, right? All right, we got to go. A whole lot of nothing going on Wall Street, really, today. The Dow down 18 points, about a 10%. The S&P and the NASDAQ basically flat, biding their time until Dr. Yellen and the gang meet tomorrow and Wednesday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.